Welcome to Space Strategy, a podcast from the American Foreign Policy Council's Space Policy Initiative, where we are shaping a vision for the next strategic frontier. Now here's your host, AFPC Senior Fellow in Defense Studies, Peter Gerritsen.
Welcome to the Space Strategy Podcast. I'm your host, Peter Gerritsen, a Senior Fellow in Defense Studies at the American Foreign Policy Council. Today, my guest is Dr. Ezinne Uzo-Okoro. Dr. Uzo-Okoro earned an undergraduate degree in computer science from the Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, as well as three master's degrees in space systems, space robotics, and public policy from Johns Hopkins, at the MIT Media Lab, and Harvard University, respectively, as well as a doctorate in aerospace engineering from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. She has nearly two decades of experience in government at both NASA and in policy. Her engineering career at NASA included significant contributions as an engineer, technical expert, manager, and executive for over 60 NASA missions and programs, which combined represent over $9.2 billion in program value to NASA. Over her career, she has contributed to Earth observation, planetary science, heliophysics, astrophysics, human exploration, and space communications missions. Today, Dr. Uzo-Okoro leads the space, aeronautics, and manufacturing portfolios within the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy, or OSTP. While at OSTP, she led and released national policies on Earth observations, orbital debris, low Earth orbit, including microgravity research, space weather, in-space servicing, assembly, and manufacturing, aeronautics, human exploration, space science, and advanced manufacturing. Well, welcome, Dr. Uzo-Okoro. I'm so delighted to have you here. So I'd like to start with you telling us a bit about your role in the space ecosystem and what space issues and opportunities command your attention.
Thank you for having me. I'm Ezinne Uzo-Okoro, and I am the Assistant Director for Space Policy at the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy. Now, the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy provides the President and others within the Executive Office of the President with advice on scientific, engineering, and technological issues. We also lead interagency science and technology policy coordination efforts, and we serve as a source of scientific and technological analysis and judgment for the President with respect to major policies, plans, and programs of the federal government. OSTP's mission is to maximize the benefits of science and technology to advance health, prosperity, security, environmental quality, justice for all Americans. And all of our portfolios vary. Mine is typically focused on civil and commercial space and aeronautics, but we will focus on space today. And some of those topics include space weather, microgravity research, low Earth orbit, Earth observations, orbital debris, human exploration, space science, in-space servicing, assembly, and manufacturing. And what you have here within our ecosystem is that within the White House, we've got a three-pronged approach to space. The first is a broad approach to space policy, and that work is done by the National Space Council in the Vice President's office. The second is a deep science and technology focused approach to space policy. And that's where OSTP leads, because we've got science and technology experts with depth in the sector. And then the third prong is our space security enterprise, and that's where the National Security Council leads on space security issues. So I hope that helps to see. So when you have all three in the room, usually the OSTP space colleague is looking at the materials and the briefing with a science and technology lens. The national security colleague is looking at all of the material with a space security lens. And of course, the Space Council is looking at the material with a broad space policy lens.
Now, OSTP has been remarkably busy during this administration, putting out just a flood of important documents. And you mentioned a few of those in what you talked about in terms of debris and low Earth orbit and microgravity and weather and ISAM. So let's start with the the one that's the most recent, which is the LEO strategy. Why was there a need for a LEO strategy, and what's in it?
You know, we started by looking about a year ago at the state of microgravity research and development. And last July 2022, we held a White House workshop and convened cross-sector stakeholders and provided OSTP with a relevant insight for continued development in space-based research and what the future of research in LEO could look like. And so with the development of this strategy, we realized that we had a few questions. We had questions around groundbreaking science and technology leadership. What role would the United States play? We had questions around collaboration within the US government on LEO R&D. How could we encourage new entrants? Questions around this inflection point we are in, particularly with the market, and asking ourselves how we could invigorate and accelerate innovation and sustainability in the market. And then when you step back even further and look at the entire landscape, we thought about how we could deepen international cooperation. How do we go together with new spacefaring nations? And I would say lastly, we also thought about the people who make the ecosystem what it is. How do we ensure that we are educating the next generation correctly? How do we ensure that we are developing the workforce correctly to deal with the future innovations that are coming to market? How do we increase opportunities and build increased capacities for institutions? So then we realized, you know, we needed to send a strong message to all of those communities within the US government, within academia, within the private sector, and to our allies and partners and strategic competitors on what we believe the future of LEO R&D looks like.
Now, I would say that several of those things you mentioned seem very consistent across all the, you know, all the various documents. You see internal competitiveness, you see inclusivity, you see inclusion of allies and partners. All that sort of flows from the space priorities framework, right? So I wanted to give you a chance to talk a little bit about the administration's document, the space priorities framework.
Thank you. And I will step back even further and say that space in this administration follows the theme across the five priorities that the president set. The first priority is on climate, another is on the economy and job creation, another is on restoring America's global leadership, another is on COVID, and the fifth is on infrastructure development. Within the space priorities framework that we released in December of 2021, our first year, one of the goals that was clear in that document was prioritization of space for the benefit of humanity. So it should be no surprise that one of the goals of this administration is to land the first woman and person of color on the moon through NASA's Artemis program. And space science is a goal. And as you saw, we participated in the James Webb Space Telescope, a historic image reveal. Space sustainability, mitigation, tracking, and characterization and remediation of space debris is work we have been busy at doing. Norms and behavior in space and leading by example in that sector. Earth observations and ensuring that climate and space technologies that we currently have and that are being developed or will be developed continue to work in tandem to ensure that we monitor and mitigate climate change. Expanding this sector of on-orbit servicing to in-space servicing, assembly, and manufacturing, looking at the rules of the road, given our focus on the moon, cislunar space as well. Most of the things I've mentioned, everything I've mentioned, stems from the U.S. space priorities document, which we released again 2 years ago. And it just shows that we are moving forward in meeting the administration's priorities and in prioritizing space for the benefit of humanity.
You mentioned their in-space assembly and manufacturing, otherwise known as ISAM. And this is, I understand, a particular area of expertise for you, as I believe you have one or more degrees in space robotics. Is that right?
That's right. So space robotics and actually on-orbit assembly are topics that I study deeply and quite narrowly. And, you know, the development of ISAM capabilities not only represents our commitment, the administration's commitment to scientific and technological innovation and economic growth, it has the potential to open new possibilities for American workers, for the commercial sector to build, repair, transport objects in space, and really to usher in an era of what I call a culture of discovery, where the potential is unbounded. We just do not know what we're going to discover, and we need to ensure that each community, communities that focus on low Earth orbit, communities that focus on cislunar space, communities that focus on Mars, all are tapping into this ecosystem of capabilities and technologies that can help us service, assemble, and manufacture and create even greater opportunities in space.
So I want to take a step back, you know, for, I'm sure many of my listeners know a lot about ISAM, but I'm sure there are a few who've never thought about it at all. So if we could just take a step back and explain, like, what is ISAM and why would it be useful for anything? You know, how is it different from what we're doing today? And what might a future look like where we have a significant maturation in ISAM technologies?
You know, the In-Space Servicing Assembly Manufacturing National Strategy was written to empower U.S. entities to develop multi-purpose technologies that would enable a new space economy on Earth and in space. We listed six strategic goals which build upon existing investments and emerging capabilities and that can chart a course for using a national approach to realize the opportunities that are enabled by ISAM as we know it. And some of those strategies are advancing R&D in ISAM, prioritizing the expansion of scalable infrastructure, which, you know, if you think about it, scalable infrastructure includes not just physical infrastructure on orbit, but also ground infrastructure, digital infrastructure as well. Another strategic goal was to accelerate the emerging ISAM commercial industry, again, accelerating that innovation that we already see that is emerging. A fourth was promoting international collaboration and cooperation. A fifth is prioritizing environmental sustainability as we move forward with ISAM capabilities, because the beauty of this time in space is something we already knew is becoming so clear, that multiple areas of space are synergistic. How can we not protect and prioritize environmental sustainability using ISAM capabilities that will also meet orbital debris goals? How could we not use infrastructure that is based here on Earth terrestrially for ground usages, for Earth to on-orbit capabilities, and then use those also for ISAM as well? And then also there's the issue of the workforce. How do we ensure that we are inspiring a diverse future workforce as a potential outcome of ISAM innovation? So we released this vision in April of 2022, so over a year ago. And about 4 months ago, we released a subsequent implementation plan that will outline activities for the United States to lead in the future of space exploration, in which American organizations, American workers are manufacturing, assembling, and repairing space systems in orbit around the moon and in deep space. And to give you specific examples, you know, we are coordinating our civil, commercial, and national security space efforts to implement ISAM capabilities that will strengthen not just U.S. leadership, but to ensure that those benefits are broadly and equitably applied throughout society. We know that it will make contributions to tackling climate crisis, and we know that it will also increase opportunities for refueling, for instance, for maneuvering in space, for tugging as an example, and a number of robotic applications for autonomy, for commoditized autonomy in space. So there just are, I hesitate to list specific examples because I don't want to leave out a specific, you know, area of research and development, and for that group to not feel us that we are thinking of them as well. But there are just so many areas here that we could list that impacts how we continue to explore, not just with our return to the moon, but further into Mars by developing more of these capabilities and technologies.
So of course, you know, I'm going to ask you about space solar power. So, you know, with the prominence that the administration places on climate, and with the sort of obvious super ambitious assembly project or manufacturing of a solar power satellite, why didn't we see space solar power get a specific call out in the ISAM or the LEO strategy?
You know, Pete, we're still studying it. It's really that simple. We need to understand it and be responsible when we commit to an assessment. We lead in three ways globally. We can lead by example. We can work bilaterally with some of our allies and partners and lead. We can also work multilaterally and show leadership for the global space community in that way. And so when we are ready, you know, the space community and the world will see it by our example. So we are very serious about ensuring that we have a crisp understanding of not just the subject matter, but our approach and our vision. And as you can see, we've been busy.
I can see that, very busy. In fact, I'm not even sure I've got like 8 documents open in PDF here, and I'm not sure I've even got them all. I've got the ISAM strategy, the LEO strategy, I've got the workforce strategy, got the debris strategy. Got the cislunar strategy, and I'm still not sure that. Oh, and I've also got the brand new National Near Earth Object Strategy and Action Plan, which, you know, let's stop for a moment on that. I mean, so this is, I think, a 5-year update or something on this, and what progress has taken place, and what's different about the new version of the Near Earth Object Strategy.
Yeah, you know, it's important for us to, as we lead by example, to update our preparedness strategies, our action plans for, in this case, near Earth objects. And this is an area that is very important. It is an area that is important because planetary defense entered a new era last year when NASA's double asteroid redirection test, so the DART mission, demonstrated the ability to alter an asteroid's orbit for the very first time. And when you consider that successful mission with the support of this worldwide campaign and also a growing global interest in hazardous near-Earth objects, asteroids and comets are things that people are talking about that could come into Earth's neighborhood. So despite all these breakthroughs, though, less than half of these near-Earth objects are capable of serious damage on Earth have been cataloged. So it makes sense, behooves us to, you know, put out these 6 goals for the next decade that will improve detection, tracking, and characterization, that will improve prediction and modeling and information integration to ensure we're not being siloed, that will, again, quite like our other strategies, increase international cooperation, ensure that we have technologies for reconnaissance, for deflection, and for disruption missions, and for strengthening and routinely ensuring that we have emergency protocols and processes in place, and also increasing our coordination within the U.S. government. So to us, it's just important that we continue to be ready. You know, one topic which we haven't gotten to yet is space weather. And it's another example of an activity that we take really seriously. We're currently updating space weather strategy and action plan. This is a congressionally mandated activity. Why? Because there are geomagnetic storms that we experience, and we need to be prepared because it affects critical infrastructure. You know, if the power in your home flickers, or if certain space companies lose satellites due to a geomagnetic storm, you know, we want to be prepared to either maneuver satellites as needed. We want to be prepared and be a space weather ready nation and ensure that our critical infrastructure is kept safe. So we don't just do this for asteroids and comets. We do this for space weather. And obviously we do this in Earth observations as well. We've got a national plan for civil Earth observations coming out later this year that we're currently working on right now to ensure that we really using all of the tools at our disposal to ensure that this data, we've got lots of satellites, both government-owned and privately-owned satellites in space, collecting data and ensuring that the firefighters get the data at the right time. So there just is so much that needs to continue to be refreshed and updated and strengthened and improved as we continue in this really exciting era of space we're in.
So this is probably a good time for me to back up and ask some very basic questions. A White House will put out such a diversity of documents. And, you know, even already we've talked about a preparedness strategy and action plan, which is a different title than these other national strategies. And then you've got implementation plans. And, you know, you have something like the Space Priorities Framework, and there's a national space policy. Help me to understand the sort of the hierarchy of these documents. And then what are they meant to do? Who do they speak to, and how do they affect the rest of the executive branch?
All of the policy documents you have mentioned are just that. They are policy documents that provide direction to the federal government. They provide information and our way of leading by example to our allies and partners, because our documents are public. These are public policy documents. And then they provide guidance and insight to stakeholders outside the U.S. government, to commercial companies, on how we are supporting them and accelerating their work and promoting their work and empowering their activities. It provides insight into the academic community on what kind of research and development activities we will be prioritizing. You know, when you think of LEO R&D and our vision for the future, that helps researchers to plan and understand the direction that the United States is going. So now to the question of hierarchy, we've got, think of them as different tools, because there are different toolkits in our toolbox. So the very broad national space policies typically need to be written in a task-specific way eventually. And that's usually what's called an implementation plan. So whenever you have a policy that is called a strategy or a vision or a directive, it eventually needs implementation so that departments and agencies within the federal government know what to do to go and implement them. So an implementation plan usually implements a broader vision of a policy that was provided earlier. Now, there are some based on the toolkits within the National Security Council, for instance. They have a vehicle of putting out specific policy directives. The National Space Council has a vehicle for putting out policy directives, for instance. You probably have heard of the regulatory work, the rules of the road work I mentioned earlier, that they are working hard on currently. And they will release that through one of their policy vehicles, and it may be called a policy directive. It may be even an executive order. You know, so there are just lots of policy vehicles. And OSTP also, as a policy office, has its policy tools as well. And you see it in the form of strategies, in the form of these implementation plans, and they are released through the what we call the National Science and Technology Council within OSTP, and that's a council of advisors to the president from different corners of the federal government. They are different policy vehicles for different offices within the White House. But then on top of it, you have, I think at the very highest level, an executive order is likely to be higher, because it has the president's signature, is likely to be higher than a policy vehicle that is done through one of the offices within the executive office of the president. Similarly, the Space Priorities Framework, which was written, again, at a broad policy level that encompasses all of space, is one that guides all of the activities in space of the offices within the EOP, is what we call the executive office of the president. So yes, within the EOP. So I hope that that helps. There are different offices with different vehicles. And if it has a president's signature, if it has been through a specific review process, it might have a greater hierarchy than other documents. But most of them, eventually, because we don't do anything that isn't important to the nation, that doesn't serve the American citizen. So it's not to say that some of the documents that do not have a presidential signature, for instance, are not policy documents. As you know, orbital debris and ISAM already have implementation plans. You may have heard some announcements from the departments and agencies who are already implementing some of the tasks that they were assigned in those implementation plans. So they just are different vehicles for us to get the message across and the work done.
Now, most of us will not have the opportunity to work in the EOP, and I imagine many of my listeners have never had the pleasure of coordinating a document through a bureaucracy. So I wanted to just portray that, you know, this is not as easy as it sounds to get any of these documents out the door. So tell the listener a little bit about, like, what is the process? You know, you mentioned that, like, you started a year or two in advance. Like, how does this document get birthed into the public sphere? Who has to coordinate on it? How long does that take? What is the formalities that it has to go through?
First, it's important to ensure that we are working on topics that align with the president's priorities. We've already gone over that. Then it's also important to conduct work that aligns with the specific office you're in. So again, with my science and technology hat, I tend to focus on things that are deeply scientific and technical in nature. And I also try to read the room. When your room is the entire United States, you might miss something. So I talk to the departments and agencies that I take briefings from the commercial sector, and those tend to validate what we've determined to be space priorities. Then once we've decided on a topic to explore, there happens to be some research, some briefings, and then the interagency is convened once we can make a case that we've got the right scope, we've got the right important topic to help accelerate progress or maintain preeminence for the United States or increase U.S. leadership in a subject matter for the next 10 to 20 years. And we look at the entire federal government. Who has equities in this topic? Who should be at the table? Do they even know the equities of the other agencies? And so we start with educating everyone on each other's equities and gaps and opportunities and challenges. And through a series of meetings, after we are clear on where everyone stands, then the process of determining what the policy should be begins. And the White House has the final pen, but the information provided by the federal departments and agencies are incredibly useful. And I see it as, frankly, us working together because we are here to serve them as well. They're not just there to carry out what we write. So it really is a negotiation. And then after that process, well, what's missing? It's the inputs from the academic community, from the nonprofit community, from the commercial community. So we tend to either hold listening sessions, hold workshops, hold summits, request information through a request for information, which is called an RFI, or a request for comment on a previous document. And that also gives us color. It gives us the pulse of the sector outside of the federal government. And usually we receive very constructive feedback. I found that the request for written feedback is the most effective because people are thoughtful in their responses. We might get as long as 20 pages, and most of them are very thoughtful. And so we review those, and you get at least 100 responses. And so we try to ensure that no stone goes untouched here, so to speak. And we end up, you know, developing what the strategy looks like. Some people have writing teams. If you've got some volunteers within the interagency, I typically don't have writing teams. And then the writing occurs, and there is, again, a lot of negotiation and back and forth. And eventually, there is a product that the interagency is willing to sign off on. And so the senior leadership signs off on the release version. And then it also gets negotiated within the executive office of the president. So I've got my colleagues that I mentioned in the other two prongs. So the National Security Council weighs in. And usually they've all been following the process anyway, so that they're not surprised at the end. The National Space Council weighs in. The Office of Management and Budget weighs in. If the National Economic Council or domestic policy, any office that has equities in the topic, or the climate office, you know, weighs in. Then we, you know, again, usually there is a negotiation with, you know, one or two agencies, either within the building or outside the building. And once that's completed successfully, it gets released. So there's a lot of patience and grace, as I like to say, that one must have to go through this process. And yes, it does take about, and we move at an accelerated pace here. So, and it still takes about, you know, 6 to 12 months for each of these to be released. And with implementation plans, that actually requires a bit more of an art because even though we've got the president's budget, we are not timing the release and the development of these implementation plans with the release of the budget. So in addition to ensuring that, you know, the Office of Management and Budget and others are on board and tracking what we are recommending, we have to make sure that the agencies really do want to take a stake in those implementation tasks, because it makes for a successful implementation.
Let's pivot a little bit and talk about, you know, an area where the United States has enjoyed pretty good external following, at least with our traditional allies and partners and some new ones, and that's Cislunar. It definitely seems as if we've had, well, quite a bit of success with various folks coming on. I don't want to steal your thunder by saying any of those, but let's talk about the Cislunar strategy and what's happening with Cislunar and Artemis and NASA's Artemis plans in general.
Yes, so, you know, as we've discussed at the very beginning, one of the president's goals is to land, and we recently made this announcement, the president recently did, is to land the first woman on the moon. We've announced the astronauts. It's very exciting. And as you're seeing, we are going together with allied nations and partners, because we have a Canadian astronaut going with the U.S. Team. So it's not an all U.S. team. That, again, in itself is exciting. It's quite like policy coming full circle. There is a saying in policy that, you know, to go far, you have to go together. So given that goal, that presidential goal, and a lot of activity in cislunar space, it was important for us to think about the decade ahead, which is critical for exploration of cislunar space, including the lunar surface, and look at what we could do to help lead, to help empower the departments and agencies as they take on this new sphere of human activity and exploration. You know, NASA estimates that over the next decade, you know, human activity in cislunar space will grow significantly. There are more countries and types of actors that are going to the moon in the years ahead, and spacefaring actors will begin to set important precedents across the next decade. Activities by each of these actors will over time, you know, affect most other actors. So we don't want to be reactionary, and it's important that we are prepared. So we support through this cislunar strategy, we support the responsible, peaceful, and sustainable exploration and use of cislunar space, including the moon, by all spacefaring nations and entities. We also support R&D to enable long-term growth. We support expanding international science and technology cooperation, expanding space situational awareness capabilities, and also implementing cislunar, you know, communications and positioning, navigation, and timing capabilities with scalable and interoperable approaches. So it just is important. We could go through each of those if you'd like, but it's important for us at a broad level, as I mentioned, with all these topics, to show that the United States is paying attention. We are not going anywhere. We intend to continue to lead, maintain our preeminence in certain areas of space. And these documents also help our federal departments and agencies as they develop their own policy documents, as they develop their own strategies to know where the White House priorities lie specifically, and to go out and boldly implement that vision.
So, you know, here again, I kind of want to just foot stomp that this is a big step forward, because, you know, we've never had a cislunar strategy before. I think that is, you know, that's brand new. Although, you know, you could make the case, you know, that, you know, we've had policies that addressed our previous efforts on the moon. You know, this really has a large economic development component, you know, built into that strategy. It talks about industrialization. It talks about scalability. It talks about using ISRU. It talks a lot about, you know, sustained presence. And at least for this policy, it seems, you know, as if NASA actually is following suit with its own policy guidance. You know, my read of the Moon to Mars objectives and Moon to Mars development seems very consistent with the White House intent in the cislunar strategy. And, you know, that definitely seems to me to be, you know, just a clear success.
No, thank you. You know, our space security arm of not just the White House, but OSCP has, I think, done a fine job of again, zooming in on this focus of us building a new sphere of human activity and, you know, going on from there into the solar system. So OSTP is really, I think that we are really proud and humbled to serve and this community at this very critical inflection point.
Now, you know, I noticed in looking at your portfolio that you also have manufacturing in general. It's pretty exciting to me to see, you know, a unity of, which by the way, I have not yet read, but I do see that there is a, you know, advanced manufacturing strategy out there. Now that I know that that's likely in your purview, I'll bump that up on my list of things to read. You know, but these two things together, you know, the potential of using off-Earth resources that might be lunar sourced or beyond, and then, you know, the in-space assembly and manufacturing, you know, really does, you know, at least tempt you to think about a potential new industrial revolution in space that might really be amazing for our national prosperity and future jobs.
It is. You stated that so well. You know, manufacturing is this engine of America's economic strength and national security, and it plays a vital role in almost every sector of the U.S. economy, you know, from aerospace to biopharmaceuticals and beyond. And advances in manufacturing not just enable the economy to continue to grow as new sectors and innovations increase productivity, but it also enables next generation products, and it helps us to support new high quality and higher paying jobs to, you know, address the climate crises. So I could go on, you know, and the National Advanced Manufacturing Strategy presents a vision for US leadership on this topic so that we can do three things. The first is developing and implementing these advanced manufacturing technologies across biomanufacturing, across artificial intelligence, you know, the across additive manufacturing, in space manufacturing, digital manufacturing, human-centered technology adoption. I could go on. The second is, how are we growing the advanced manufacturing workforce and expanding, you know, and ensuring that we have a diverse talent pool and that we're scaling up and promoting education and training. And then the third is, how are you building resilience into the manufacturing supply chains and ecosystems? So I'm really glad you brought this up, because the supply chains and, you know, ecosystem, how do we stimulate supply chain agility and improve supply chain risk management and even increase visibility into supply chains, for instance, are all examples, a few. I could go into more if you'd like, but just a few examples of what we're doing through the CHIPS and Science Act, you know, through the Inflation Reduction Act. And it affects the, you know, aerospace sector greatly, all the high performance alloys and stainless steel and transformers and wires and cables that are used for developing space systems are all developed, you know, here on this planet and are part of the manufacturing ecosystem. So it's really important. I encourage you to read it. I think we have about 11 strategic objectives and 37 program recommendations there. It's just, you know, a light reading.
Now, you sound extremely optimistic about where we can go.
I am, because again, I just see us as at this place where the commercial sector is brimming with ideas. The government is continuing to undergo this paradigm shift. What paradigm shift is that? Well, there is this, there's a greater embrace of what the commercial sector has to offer, this commercial sector leadership in a number of these topics. Think about the ISS transitioning into a privately owned commercial space station. That is exciting. It's empowering for a commercial company or two or three to be able to do that. The International Space Station is this beacon of international success. And to think that that's going to go from something that's government owned to something that's privately owned, I think is incredible. So how do we make sure that that happens, one, smoothly, two, timely, and three, without leaving behind anything we've done, but also continue to conduct transformational science, to continue to have rapid, repeatable science, to improve upon what the International Space Station already does. And this is why, with the LEO R&D strategy, with Cisternar Space, with strategy, with ISAM, with orbital debris, with Earth observations, we work so well together, I think, as a team, that all of those things require some regulatory updates. And we bundled that together, and it's now in the hands of the National Space Council, and they've been working hard on these rules of the road. And I'm just thrilled that what they come out with will complete the circle here, where we have shown how we will continue to advance scientifically and technologically and what our vision is. And then we're going to have new rules of the road and updated rules as needed that shows us how we're going to get there. So to be able to clear the path for all of the ideas that we keep hearing about, all the innovations that commercial companies want to put out there, I think it's just really exciting. It's a very exciting time to be in space.
Well, I certainly agree there. And, you know, when you talked earlier about reading the room, you know, it definitely seems to me as if the language in all these documents certainly reads where the space advocacy and commercial community would like to go. I mean, it's very clear that it's very friendly towards commercialization. It's unafraid to use novel and big, you know, words like industrialization or settlement. And it has a real consistent concern for the industrial base and growing the workforce in the long term, which I think is really laudable. You know, one of the things that you mentioned, you know, that I think is interesting is, you know, in all these documents, we're talking about such a diversity of novel space activities, everything from in-space manufacturing to in-space biomanufacturing to, you know, extractive industries to in-space constructive industries. And I know that the White House has talked about its interest in providing a greater clarity on regulating novel space activities. Where do you see us going with that?
Yeah, so I've touched on this a few times, and I think that where I see us going is we come out of, so we're in this black box as part of the process, right? We've had listening sessions, and a lot of input has been provided from the public. The interagency is working hard to provide inputs, and the process is, you know, sensitive and deliberative. And again, our colleagues in the National Space Council side are working hard on the process. And whatever comes out of this process, I believe that the outputs will only serve as yet another contribution to this, again, era of space that we are all working to realize. It will include regulatory and just standards and rules of the road for ISAM, for orbital debris, for cislunar, and whatever else we haven't covered in LEO. It's just everyone is quite passionate, and I just believe that the process will result in a great product ultimately. It would be really exciting.
I want to change tactics a little bit and just ask, you know, for when we talk about workforce development, it's always interesting to know, you know, where people, you know, how people got to where they are today. And so, you know, you yourself, I think, had a really, really interesting career trajectory. And so, you know, looking back on it, what is the story? Like, how did you start from being a wannabe inventor, you know, as a kid, to ending up inventing our entire in-space and advanced manufacturing system for the nation?
One thing I do consistently is putting one foot in front of the other. And that has shown that you can eventually, I guess, accomplish things and that would be beneficial to the nation. And it really is my privilege and my honor to do this work. I studied computer science because I wanted to invent things out of thin air, and I thought software would allow me to do that, and it did. And my first day at NASA, it was July 12th, and it was the year that Cassini, a year on the day that Cassini inserted itself into Saturn's orbit after 9 years of traveling. And so I was put on the Cassini mission, and I was the programmer, you know, analyzing what we were receiving from the Cassini plasma spectrometer. And just that first experience over those 3 months, I said, you know, I want to do more of this. I'm going to build spacecraft. How do I learn? There are all these people here to teach me. I want to learn to be a mechanical engineer and learn propulsion and optics and power. And we just really have a rich ecosystem in the systems that we build. And it's a thrill to be, and frankly, an honor to be one of those who get to do that. So I focused on strong technical, you know, development for the first 10 years of my career, contributed to, you know, hands-on development for 7 missions, and then became, to go from being an engineer, a baby engineer, to an engineer, to a manager of people, and then a manager of projects and programs. And I moved around a bit to expand my worldview. I moved from NASA Center to NASA Center. And after working on large spacecraft, I heard about small satellites and wanted to work on those, and managed several programs and contributed to so many missions. I stopped counting at 60. And what I found was this, you know, trend. We were moving from spacecraft that was the size of school buses to these innovative techniques with smaller and smaller satellites. And I thought, well, very soon this is going to become a commodity like cars, and we're going to have to build them off an assembly line. So why not add robotics in the mix? So NASA is very great at encouraging people to go to school while working, so in your spare time, because they don't believe that that there is a substitute for the experience you get while working. And so that's what I did. You know, at nighttime, I would study what more I needed to innovate more. And eventually I decided that I needed to understand policy, because somewhere down the line, I would need to converse with policymakers about all these inventions. And, you know, the White House happened to call after 17 years of working at the agency. And I'm so glad they did. It really is a privilege to work here. It's and to shape a small part of the future, to shape the future of space, to really help our sector move along, and also adjacent sectors, you know, aeronautics and the future of electric vehicles and advanced air mobility and drones and hypersonic systems and supersonic systems, and also our supply chains and resiliency and advanced manufacturing, and see how connected the entire U.S. Economy is, and how manufacturing and supply chain resiliency affects our work in space, and the synergies between our work in astronautics and the work in aeronautics. So it really has been the privilege of a lifetime. And I think I got lucky. So because you can work hard and still not end up at a place like this, but I think I got lucky. I'm glad I did.
Now, you know, most people will think that Cislunar is far, but you actually did some work with exoplanets as well, right?
That's right. So the Transiting Exoplanet Survey Satellite, it's called TESS, was one of the missions I worked on very early in my career. And it is a success right now. It's still discovering exoplanets. We also know that the James Webb Space Telescope, which I worked on here at the White House by planning the presidential, it was supposed to be a, you know, the president thanking the team, because I just thought they did phenomenal work. I mean, we all know that they did phenomenal work. And then it ended up being part of their reveal. And that was a historic and unforgettable experience, and to see the exoplanets being discovered there as well. But yeah, I really believe that in the next decade, we will not only discover more exoplanets, but we will be developing technologies that allows us to explore them.
So, you know, one of the extremely bold words in the LEO strategy is settlement. And I know that that was something that folks in the National Space Society and Space Frontier Foundation and Alliance for Space Development have been hoping to see in policy literally for decades. And I think this is the first time. I wonder, are you able to say anything about that, about the inclusion of the word settlement within LEO, and at first as a policy question, and then sort of secondarily, just as a personal, you know, somebody studying exoplanets, are you optimistic that humanity will ever find a second home among the stars?
I think we're all optimistic that very much is that we have all envisioned could be on the horizon. And the reason it's stated that way in the policy is precisely that. It's, we are very careful and intentional with what we right. We hope that the policies read as succinctly and as brief as, because we could say more as we'd like them to read. And what we write is how we view it. So there isn't anything else to it.
So, you know, as we close up here in our final minutes, you know, there's so much in each of these strategies. And of course, there's a separate strategy on the space workforce and STEM. And, you know, so I want to give you a chance to sort of talk directly to listeners that might be following behind us, you know, in another generation about what's ahead and how they might, you know, what should they be thinking about if they want to work in this area? What should they set their sights on? And what are the keys to success?
What should you set your sights on? A very wise man who worked in the National Space Council in the last administration told most of us when we were starting to grab an oar. And I think that's the right approach because there's just so much to be done here. And I like to say when I speak to young people that space is this multidisciplinary phenomenon where anyone can play. So you need not be a scientist or an engineer with a specific skill set in that area. There are lots of skill sets we need in design and architecture and digital infrastructure and cybersecurity and others. So I would say grab an oar to what you are passionate about. And as far as the topics, again, there's so many with space science. If your calling is, you know, in astrophysics or planetary science, there just is so many, there are so many discoveries ahead of us, ahead of not just what the James Webb Space Telescope will reveal, but furthermore, with climate monitoring and Earth observations, we need to acquire more commercial Earth observations and geospatial data for the US government. We may need more satellites that look at use different bands for space-based research in LEO. We need all the help we can get to transition the ISS in 7 years and retire it in 7 years, but transition it to a commercial space station. So you could start your company or work for a company that is intending on providing a plethora of services, whether they are the entire station itself or they are a provider of, you know, docking services or tourism, or a number of scientific experiments or a number of things. But space sustainability, we need more people in tracking and characterization of debris. We need more people with innovations in remediation of debris in space and mitigation of debris before the rocket or the spacecraft launches. But space weather, we will always continue to be a space weather ready nation and ensure that the nation's ability to improve space weather forecasts and warnings are outstanding. We will always need heliophysicists to help guide our space companies on how to maneuver from geomagnetic storms in space. With space technology, I mean, for our in-space servicing, assembly, and manufacturing, you can refuel in orbit. You could design robots that will dock and berth and maneuver and tug. You could manufacture in space. You could assemble in different orbits with international cooperation. If that's your area of expertise, you could work with other nations and bring other spacefaring nations along with us as we go on these activities. We didn't even get to planetary protection, but on planetary defense, what's cooler than protecting the planet from asteroids and comets? And lastly, with, you know, aeronautics, we fly all the time and we will need to use some of our aeronautics infrastructure to go to space or to continue to advance technology in air travel. And that's a very exciting time that we are approaching where air travel gets combined with space rockets. So looking forward to that. And there's so much people can do. So I would just say focus on where your passion is and get to work.
Dr. Uzoa-Carl, thank you so much for spending time and letting us understand what the White House is up to and a bit of your own vision and strategy.
Thank you for having me.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Space Strategy Podcast. Please be sure to subscribe wherever you are listening. For questions and comments, please reach out at spacepod@afpc.org. Thank you for listening.